Welcome, Truth Seekers. On behalf of the Great Awakening Report, I want to formally welcome you to this week's Truth Seekers Weekly Briefing Subscriber Q&A for August 14th.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
And, you know, trying to read the news lately, I mean, it really feels like someone has wired like 5 different radio stations to play at the exact same time in your house.
Oh, absolutely.
You've got these geopolitical conflicts blasting in one ear and then massive economic shifts in the other, plus all these wild technological breakthroughs, the domestic political drama. It's just this complete wall of static. And honestly, it is exhausting.
It is. It creates this constant state of like low-level anxiety. Mm-hmm. When you try to process all of those massive, complex signals simultaneously, your brain just, well, it goes into overload.
Right.
You can't hear the actual music. You just hear the noise.
Which is exactly why we're stepping back today. We're taking a deep dive into this recent document that attempts to kind of cut through all of that static. So today's deep dive is focusing on the August 14th report, which is titled The Great Global Convergence.
Yeah, that's the one.
And the mission here is to move past the daily news cycle, you know, and basically take a masterclass in connecting the dots. We're going to look at these systemic pressures, geopolitics, economic compression, tech disruption, all of it impartially, because true power really lies in regaining your sovereignty through discernment rather than fear.
Exactly. And to do that, you really need to take what you might call the observer position.
The observer position. What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, it means you stop reacting emotionally to whatever headline the algorithm feeds you today. Instead, you step back and you look for the underlying architecture. The goal isn't to just, you know, replace one mainstream narrative with an alternative narrative.
Right. Trading one box for another.
Yeah, exactly. It's about seeing how these threads cross multiple domains to form much larger patterns. It's about recognizing signals versus noise.
Well, let's put that observer position to the test right away, because we're going to review 7 specific subscriber questions from this report in exact order. And these really reveal what's actually changing beneath the surface.
Yeah, let's jump in. The first one is a big one.
It is. So here is the exact wording for question 1. Are all these events really connected, or are we simply living through an unusually chaotic period?
And that's such a human question, isn't it? Our brains are basically pattern recognition machines. We constantly want to draw lines between everything.
We want a grand narrative, yeah. We want to believe someone is in charge, even if it's the bad guys.
Right. But we have to be extremely careful about assuming every global shock is orchestrated by some central committee pulling levers behind the curtain. What this report is tracking and what we're genuinely seeing are real systems relationships.
Okay, systems relationships. Break that down for me.
So it's not necessarily a secret coordinated mechanism. It's just the sheer physics of modern interdependence. Let's map it out. Think about, say, instability in the Middle East.
Okay, sure.
That instability doesn't just stay regional. It immediately disrupts global energy markets, specifically natural gas. Now, natural gas isn't just used for heating your home. It's actually the primary chemical feedstock for creating nitrogen fertilizer.
Oh, wow. Okay, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so when the energy market spikes, the fertilizer market spikes right along with it. Suddenly, farmers all over the world are paying double just to grow their crops.
Which means the global food supply becomes way more expensive.
Exactly. That drives up core inflation everywhere. And what happens when inflation goes up? Central banks across the world are forced to hike interest rates.
And that interest rate hike dictates whether, you know, a family in Ohio can actually afford a mortgage.
You see, that's the chain.
So it's not someone tweaking a master dial just to ruin the housing market. It's this energy shock cascading through the physical supply chain until it literally hits your personal bank account.
That's the physics of it, yes.
It makes me think of our world right now as this massive audio soundboard. And right now, it's like someone has shoved multiple sliders, you know, technology, finance, geopolitics, energy, all the way up at the exact same time.
That's a great analogy. Uh-huh. And that interdependence is the true signal here. Disruptions propagate incredibly fast today because there's almost no slack left in the system.
Right.
So our goal as observers is just to watch where these pressures accumulate without forcing every single dot into some predetermined conspiracy.
Okay, so that brings us to the system that is feeling that pressure most acutely right now, which is the economy. The readers of this report are clearly feeling it. Here's the exact second question. Are we approaching a major economic reset or simply entering a difficult new economic era?
Yeah, and looking at the surface, I mean, it is rough out there. You look at weak employment indicators, astronomical government borrowing, high debt.
FII completely upending the job market,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, absolutely. The pressure is undeniable. The era of 0% interest rates and, you know, cheap capital, it's totally over. We're being forced into a very painful structural adjustment. But, and this is a critical distinction, a difficult structural adjustment is not necessarily an imminent apocalyptic collapse.
See, I have to push back there. Because we hear the word collapse thrown around daily.
Yeah.
Why is this report and your analysis suggesting adaptation instead of just a total failure of the system?
Well, declaring an overnight collapse kind of ignores the incredible adaptive capability of the global market.
Hmm.
There is still massive productive capacity out there, deep capital markets. The system bends and it groans loudly, but it's remarkably resilient.
But wait, here's where I think it gets really interesting. Is the real shift happening in the actual plumbing of money? Because the report mentions things like BRICS payment initiatives, CBDCs, tokenization.
Yes, exactly. The actual infrastructure of money is being entirely rebuilt right beneath our feet while everyone is distracted by, you know, what the Federal Reserve is doing with interest rates. This financial transition is a process, not a sudden reset day.
Let's unpack those buzzwords, though, because for the average person listening right now, how is a CBDC, a central bank digital currency, actually any different from the digital dollars they already look at on their Chase or Bank of America app?
That's the most important question to ask.
Yeah.
Because on your screen, they look identical. But the architecture behind them is completely fundamentally different. Right now, those numbers on your banking app represent an IOU from your commercial bank.
Okay. The bank owes me that money. They manage the ledger.
Right. A central bank digital currency, however, is a direct liability of the central bank itself. It's essentially a programmable digital token issued straight from the government, bypassing the commercial bank entirely.
Wow. Okay, so instead of my local bank tracking it, the central bank could directly issue and program the currency.
Yes. And then you add in tokenization.
Right. What does it actually mean to tokenize an asset?
It means taking a real-world asset, like a piece of real estate or a bond, and representing the ownership rights of that asset as a digital token on a shared blockchain. It allows for instant settlement. You don't wait 3 days for a stock trade to clear through clearinghouses. The token simply moves from your wallet to mine instantly.
Which fundamentally changes how value moves globally. But, I mean, if the actual money we use is becoming totally digital and programmable, that forces a massive change in how we interact with the system. Because to use digital money, you have to digitally prove who you are.
Exactly. They go hand in hand.
Which connects directly to the third question in the report. And this is a massive concern for the subscribers. Let me read it exactly. Are digital-eyed age verification and biometric surveillance leading toward a system of digital control?
And we absolutely have to acknowledge that the tech for that kind of system exists right now.
Uh-huh.
Facial recognition, interconnected government databases, persistent smartphone tracking, the tools are fully developed.
The capability is there.
But, and this is the key takeaway for you listening right now, technological capability does not make a universal control system inevitable. Technology is always a dual-use tool.
So what does this all mean for us practically? Explain how a digital ID system could be built that doesn't turn into some centralized tracking nightmare.
It all comes down to the architecture. You could absolutely build a centralized system, a giant honeypot database that tracks every time you buy coffee or board a plane. That concentrates institutional power.
Right, the dystopian model.
But using the exact same underlying cryptography, you could build a decentralized identity system using something called zero-knowledge proofs.
Okay, zero-knowledge proofs. Slow down for a second. How does that actually work for me in real life?
Think about going to a bar right now. To prove you're 21, you hand the bouncer your driver's license.
Yeah.
You're giving them your exact home address, your birth date, your height, your organ donor status, just to prove one single thing, that you are over 21.
Huh. I never thought about it like that, but yeah, I'm oversharing data.
A zero-knowledge proof is like having a mathematical bouncer. You ping this system, and it simply outputs a binary yes or no regarding whether you meet the age requirement. It doesn't reveal a single piece of your underlying data to the bar.
That is a brilliant analogy. So the technology could be designed to protect individual autonomy just as easily as it could concentrate power.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And what this report is pointing out is that we are in the highly critical window right now where these standard-setting decisions are being made. The danger isn't that a sci-fi dystopia arrives tomorrow.
It's the slow creep.
Yes. its convenience gradually evolving into a mandatory interoperable identification system, and it all happens without any real democratic debate.
Well, and when you see that kind of potential institutional overreach, it naturally leads to public pushback. People start demanding institutional transparency, especially about things that have been kept secret for decades.
Oh, absolutely. Which perfectly bridges to the next topic.
Yes. Question four, and I'll state it exactly as the subscribers asked it. Is UEP disclosure finally moving towards something substantial?
Now, I know some people might think, wait, UFOs, what does that have to do with economics?
Right. Talking about UAPs in the same breath as financial plumbing sounds wild. But it's fundamentally a question about whether we can trust institutional narratives, isn't it?
It is. And as impartial observers, we have to note a truly historic institutional shift here. For 70 years, this topic was totally culturally marginalized. I mean, it was career suicide for a pilot or a politician to discuss it.
Yep, you'd be laughed out of the room.
But now, we're seeing formal congressional hearings, we're seeing whistleblower protections, and high-ranking intelligence officials testifying under oath about non-human technology. That behavioral shift by the institutions is highly significant.
It is significant. But I want to jump in and point out that testimony, even under oath before Congress, isn't the same thing as physical proof.
No, it's not.
I mean, people can be misinformed or they can just lie. The report details a very specific evidence sequence that listeners need to watch. It goes from reporting to testimony, then documentation, declassification, and finally, independent verification.
And that observer stance is crucial here. We have to take a highly disciplined approach. When officials testify, it demands serious investigation. But you cannot declare these claims proven until the underlying sensor data, the radar telemetry, the physical material, is fully accessible to independent scientific researchers.
Right. Without the receipts, testimony is just a story. We have to demand the evidence. And, you know, questioning domestic institutions like this naturally mirrors how nations around the world are currently questioning the dominant global institution.
The U.S. dollar?
Exactly. Question five, is the world moving away from the U.S. dollar and toward an entirely new financial system?
And look, people have been predicting the demise of the dollar for decades. But we are seeing a genuine multipolar shift now.
Because the infrastructure is finally catching up, right?
Exactly. The dollar is so incredibly embedded in global debt and systems like SWIFT that it's not going to just vanish overnight. If it did, it would trigger a global depression.
So if it's not vanishing overnight, it's kind of like, imagine the global economy is this massive transportation network.
Okay, I'm with you.
For the last 50 years, the U.S. dollar has been the only major interstate highway. If you wanted to move big goods, you had to drive on it and you had to pay the tolls. What I'm seeing now isn't countries trying to dynamite the main highway. They're actively building a series of new interconnected side roads.
That's a perfect way to visualize it.
Yeah.
Countries want additional pathways for settlement. They're setting up bilateral trade in rupees, in yuan, in riyas, so they don't have to rely exclusively on the dollar.
They want options.
Exactly. If the main highway gets blocked by sanctions, they'd take the side road. I'm bringing it back to our earlier point. The infrastructure is key here. Who gets to pave those new roads? Who sets the technical standards for these interconnected digital networks? That will decide the real future of money.
Wow. Okay. So we've covered macroeconomic shifts, digital identity, institutional transparency, the global financial highway. If you are listening to this right now, this level of macro compression probably feels incredibly daunting.
Oh, it's a lot to process.
Yeah. Which leads directly to the most practical question the subscribers asked. Question six. Should we be preparing for systemic disruption in energy, food, housing, and supply chains?
Right. How does the individual navigate all this?
Exactly. Because it's easy to just panic.
Well, preparation is always sensible.
Right.
We just talked about how interconnected the chain reactions are. Weather affects water, which affects energy, which is food, transportation, and then the economy.
The physics of it.
Yes. But we strongly have to counter this whole doomsday narrative. The idea that you need to go buy a bunker tomorrow. Modern systems actually have a lot of redundancy built in. There are substitution mechanisms.
Right. The adaptive capacity you mentioned earlier.
Exactly. If one material gets too expensive, the market innovates and finds a substitute. A disruption is a hardship, sure. But it doesn't automatically mean systemic collapse.
So the preparation strategy isn't about hoarding out of fear. It's about increasing your options, maintaining reasonable household supplies, having financial liquidity, avoiding heavy leverage.
Yes, resilience over fear.
The right question for you to ask isn't, is the world ending? It's, where is the system adapting and how can I increase my own resilience? because preparation should relieve your anxiety, not reinforce it.
And physical resilience is really only half the equation here.
Right, which brings us to the deeper shift happening within the human mind. The final question, question 7. What does all of this mean for the conscious awakening, and where do we go from here?
And this is where it all ties together. What we're really seeing is the massive democratization of information. Millions of people are now completely bypassing traditional media gatekeepers.
But, you know, I have to say, information abundance doesn't automatically produce truth.
No, it doesn't.
I mean, algorithms are specifically designed to amplify emotion, usually anger or fear, to keep us scrolling. And we see these alternative echo chambers forming that are just as rigid as the mainstream ones.
Which is why the role of discernment is the central thesis here. Awakening might begin with questioning the outside world, but it matures through true discernment. And that means aggressively questioning what you want to believe, just as much as what you distrust.
That's powerful. Holding your own comfortable narratives to the same rigorous standard as the ones you hate.
It's the hardest part of the process.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, tying these 7 questions together, the report provides a framework for navigating this transition from basically the matrix to higher frequency living. 4 actionable pillars.
Yes. The first pillar is letting go of fear, which is really the master key of control. When you drop the fear, you regain your clarity.
And the second pillar is practicing forgiveness and emotional clearing, you know, literally removing that heavy energetic residue so you can process all this new information clearly.
Exactly. Then the third pillar is utilizing meditation and transformational breathing, not to escape the world, but to anchor yourself firmly in the present.
And the fourth is living with the heart of a volunteer, showing up for your community.
Because you can't control the macroeconomic shifts, but you can control how you act locally.
So to you, the listener, I want to ask you directly. Are you being pulled by fear right now, or are you grounded in peace? Are you running around outside acting in the movie? Or are you going within to watch it consciously? Is your mental atmosphere vibrationally aligned at 50% or higher?
It's a daily, moment-by-moment choice to step out of the matrix and stay aligned.
Stay awake, stay empowered, and keep connecting the dots.
And as you go about your week, I want to leave you with one final unexplored thought to just mull over.
Let's hear it.
If we are actively moving toward this multipolar, totally decentralized world in both finance and information, what does human society actually look like when there's absolutely no central authority left to agree upon reality? What happens when every single individual is forced to become their own ultimate arbiter of truth?
Now that is something to think about.